Hi, Marco Werman here with a quick reminder before the show. Right now we're fundraising for the world with a goal of raising $100,000. Yeah, we know that is a big number, but when you're creating a show with the in-depth human-centered reporting that you rely on, there are big expenses, and that's where we need your help. Our coverage is part of how you make sense of current events. You listen to this podcast to feel connected. It's part of your day. So please donate at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Do it today. And now, the show.
Soccer fans from across the globe are heading to Qatar to party at the World Cup, but they just got word of a change of plans.
Actually, no beer. It's just 2 days before the opening of this tournament that this country's been waiting 10 years for.
Also ahead, in Honduras, a land dispute. Honduran police are threatening to evict the residents of an indigenous community from their ancestral land.
Terror, pues, sembró terror en todos nosotros, en los niños.
This man says the last eviction attempt sowed terror and the kids went running. Plus, a 19-year-old Pakistani youth activist goes to the UN climate conference. For her, climate change is not an abstraction.
These problems, these losses, and these damages are not in my people's tomorrow. They are from my yesterday.
I'm Carol Hills. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The United Nations Climate Summit in Egypt was supposed to wrap up today. That's not happening. Negotiators are still locked in discussions. The biggest divide remains around the issue of paying for loss and damage from climate change. That means whether to create a fund where richer nations that have historically emitted more greenhouse gases will pay for damages in developing countries. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler has been following one youth activist from Pakistan at the talks and brings us this story.
Hi, my name is Fatma. I'm a climate activist, youth spokesperson, and global rights advocate.
I met with Fatma Sultan at her family's house in Karachi a few days before she flew to Egypt.
My to-do list is so jammed.
She's like curled up on a couch in a cozy sweatshirt and jeans, interrupting her trip prep to talk to me.
Find my clothes, email Egyptian embassy, check my dengue test.
Sultan is 19, taking a year off before college to work with the international climate group Fridays for Future. She says a sense of injustice is what motivates her.
I think the statistic that scared me the most, that was like Pakistan is like one of the least contributors to the carbon emissions, and it's one of the highest affected. And I was like, how is that okay? I have to do something.
Her family wasn't badly affected during this year's historic floods, but back in 2020,
we were like in our house for like 5 days. There was like no electricity, and we got lucky, but a lot of my friends, like, their houses got flooded.
She wanted to go to the summit to push for things that would help Pakistan.
Because we just have to take the hits again and again and again and again.
At the summit, she's been writing statements, doing interviews, and speaking on panels.
Coming from a developed nation as a young voice,
her focus since arriving, like much of the world's, has zeroed in on the loss and damage issue. She spoke about that today.
These problems, these losses, and these damages are not in my people's tomorrow. They are from my yesterday, they are from my today, and they are from my tomorrow.
For most of this conference, developing countries pushed for a firm commitment to a fund for losses and damages. Developed countries have wanted to keep looking for the best funding options and decide the issue at a later climate conference.
Hello.
Hi, Fatma.
Hi, how are you? Can you hear me?
Yesterday, I called Sultan to ask her what stood out to her about the summit.
The biggest thing is that there's a huge divide between, like, developed nations and, like, developing. It comes out into the atmosphere as well, because you can see, like, there's a lot of tension.
That tension came through during a panel on Wednesday about the creation of a loss and damage fund.
The people who do not contribute anything significant to the greenhouse gases and suffering the most, they're the ones that need help. And that is not happening.
Many here can afford to delay decisions. Most of us cannot.
That was Molwyn Joseph from Antigua and Barbuda and Sherry Raymond from Pakistan. By Thursday, talks on the loss and damage issue were stalled.
We are at crunch time in the negotiations.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged negotiators to reach an agreement on this issue.
There has been clearly a breakdown in trust between North and South and between developed and emerging economies.
I asked Fatima Sultan if she thought this whole process was working.
I wouldn't say it's functioning well, but I do think it is one of the only spaces for people to be held to some sort of accountability.
Last night, there was a breakthrough in negotiations. The European Union reversed earlier oppositions to propose a deal on the loss and damage fund in exchange for stronger emissions cuts. Today, negotiators debated the details. The talks look set to continue through the weekend. When I met with Fatima Sultan in Karachi, we went to the beach near her house. It'll be vulnerable to sea level rise. I asked her how she thinks about climate change here and the world's ability to work together to tackle it.
Like, it makes me fearful. It makes me skeptical. But I think seeing how far, like, modernization and global development has come, like, Pakistan was a former colony. Like, a lot of things that were impossible have been made possible. So I don't see why I should shut the door on that.
Today, Sultan sent me a message. After spending the last 2 weeks at these high-level climate talks, she says she's still skeptical. But seeing developing nations stick together at this moment also gives her hope. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
If you look at recent photos from the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv, Russian shelling has reduced parts of the city to rubble, entire streets destroyed. It's similar in other cities caught up in war in Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, or Ethiopia. Your heart breaks a little for the people who live there. Today in Dublin, some 75 countries have been signing on to an agreement to prevent such tragedies by refraining from bombing in urban areas. It's the first time countries have agreed to curb the use of explosive weapons in population centers. Laura Ballot is the coordinator of the International Network on Explosive Weapons, and she joins us now from Dublin. Laura, what's in the agreement? What are these countries agreeing to do?
At the very core of this declaration is an obligation to place limits on the use of explosive weapons in cities and towns and other populated areas. But it also has commitments in it to help victims of explosive weapon use. And it requires states to gather data on civilian casualties and the impacts of explosive weapon use to better understand the problem.
Why do we need this agreement? I mean, isn't it already against the rules of war to bomb civilian targets?
Well, international law and the laws of war, they prohibit direct targeting of civilians and indiscriminate use of weapons. But there isn't any international agreement that expressly deals with the use of explosive weapons in city centres. And so we're talking about things like aircraft bombs, rockets, missiles. These are very heavy explosive weapons. They impact a very wide area with blast and shrapnel fragmentation. Many of them are inaccurate. They can land, you know, far away from the target. Some of them fire multiple munitions across a wider area. These are entirely inappropriate for use in populated areas where civilians are at severe risk of being killed or injured. Hospitals, schools, electricity lines, water, sanitation systems are destroyed. That has huge knock-on effects for not only the people living in that city, but also the areas outside of it.
Now, which countries have signed on, and perhaps more to the point, which ones haven't?
There are now 80 countries that are signing on, and from all regions of the world. It includes some of the major users of explosive weapons, so it's two-thirds of the NATO countries. The United States is signing on, the UK, France, Germany. There's also some affected countries like Palestine and Somalia. And there are some of the users that haven't signed on to this agreement. Russia, for example, has stayed outside of the talks on this issue and isn't signing today, neither is Israel. But it is a big group of states, and I think it really represents quite a committed group of countries that want to see action being taken on this issue.
You mentioned that Russia has not signed on to this agreement. Has Ukraine signed on?
Ukraine has not signed on. They were here at the conference today, and they've spoken in the meeting to say that they support the aims of this declaration, that they hope to sign on to the declaration in the future.
I was wondering, because with the war in Ukraine going on and population centers there being targeted, I'm wondering whether that fact has given this agreement momentum, because people are seeing this going on now.
Absolutely. I think it has. I mean, the negotiations of this agreement were taking place when the war in Ukraine had started, when our TV screens were dominated by images of destruction, of rocket attacks, missiles and bombing in Ukraine's major towns and cities. But it is also a pattern of harm that we've seen in a range of different countries around the world, in Syria, Iraq, Yemen. It's a widespread pattern of harm. And we've found that when heavy explosive weapons are used in towns and cities, 90% of the victims are civilians. So I think the support that we're seeing for this international agreement today is based on some long-standing concerns that this humanitarian situation is unacceptable and it needs to stop.
Laura Boileau is the coordinator of the International Network on Explosive Weapons. She's been telling us about an agreement signed by more than 75 countries to refrain from bombing urban areas. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
In some parts of the world, trying to defend the land you live on can come with risks. In Honduras, violent land evictions have been common, even deadly. The new government there has promised to resolve these conflicts. Still, the threat of eviction looms. Reporter Anna Catherine Brigida reports from one community in Honduras that's grappling with conflicting claims.
Corn is being picked and processed this Saturday in the farming community of Tierras del Padre. About 120 families could be evicted from here on November 23rd. A businessman from one of the most powerful families in the country claims to hold the title to more than 500 acres of land. But members of the indigenous Lenca community have lived there all their lives. They hold an ancestral title to the land, recognized under national and international law. One of these residents is 40-year-old Elmer Posadas.
Esta es mi milpa, mire, todo esto.
This is my cornfield, he says. All of it would be lost. Posadas typically carries his machete around for his work in the fields. But he told me that he'll leave it at home if the police come to evict them. Even though the police have beat them in past eviction attempts, their resistance remains peaceful. Posadas says their last attempt in February sowed terror in the residents and their children. When one of my daughters saw the police, she ran and I had to go after her because her nerves took hold of her and she went running towards the mountain. Violent land evictions have been frequent in Honduras, particularly after a 2009 coup that ushered in a conservative, pro-business government. Indigenous and campesino communities live on coveted land for tourism, development projects, and lucrative agricultural production. Kelsey Yost-Skrigan is a lawyer at Columbia's Human Rights Law Clinic. She says powerful business interests have found ways to stake a claim in these lands.
Pressuring through violence and threats people to sell at a price that completely undervalued the land, to just flouting the rules and the laws of what was supposed to happen to have an appropriate transfer of the title of these lands.
In January, President Xiomara Castro took office and shifted the government to the left after more than a decade of conservative rule. Yost-Skrigan says there was hope for change. But then last week, police and military violently evicted a Garifuna community in Punta Gorda on the island of Roatan.
It's really not an overnight change when you have practices that have been ingrained.
The Minister of the Secretary of Human Rights, Natalie Roque, says repression during evictions is never justified.
Poner orden no es violentar derechos humanos.
Establishing order does not mean violating human rights, she says. Violence was normalized as a response, but our principal commitment is changing this. The long-term solution, she says, is to study the potentially fraudulent granting of land titles under the past government, and to stop accusing communities of a crime just for living on their land. I was unable to get in touch with the businessman that disputes the ancestral claim to Tierras del Padre. However, Gustavo Solorzano of the Honduran Council of Private Businesses says he believes it's possible to reach an agreement that respects both private and ancestral ownership claims. Whatever the result from the court, there is going to be dissatisfaction from one side. And this is going to cause social conflict, he says. Social conflict that can be avoided if the proper dialogues have been established to resolve it. But residents of Tierras del Padre say this is their way of life and the only home they've ever known. It's not up for debate. That's why community president Pedro Lagos has been working tirelessly to stop the upcoming eviction.
Estamos confiados esperando de que...
We're trusting and hoping that we don't arrive to that day, he says, and that we can release ourselves from this stress that we have. For The World, I'm Anna Catherine Brigida in Tierras del Padre, Honduras.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. When the richest man on the planet bought Twitter for a cool $44 billion, he got busy right away firing people. Then Elon Musk urged the remaining staff to consider whether they are, as he put it, extremely hardcore about Twitter. If not, he said they too should find the door. Well, it looks like a lot of staff can't get to the exits quick enough. And the hashtag RIP Twitter is now trending. Twitter is based in San Francisco, but it is very much a global company. Today, we wanted to look at the international implications of what's happening at Twitter. Victoria Elliott is a platforms and power reporter at Wired, and she's been covering the meltdown at Twitter. Victoria, at this point, is the Twitter headquarters in San Francisco feeling pretty empty?
Well, to be clear, I'm based in New York, so I'm kind of watching the exodus along with everyone else. Ironically, also all on Twitter. It's kind of crazy to watch the platform go through such momentous changes on its own interface. People's access badges have been turned off. Many, many people who were given until 5 p.m. yesterday to sort of commit to Musk's vision of Twitter 2.0 decided to take severance and leave. I think a number that I saw, and I can't confirm, was that there's about 238 people still officially left. We really don't know what the situation is.
What about offices elsewhere in the world? Are there layoffs and resignations there as well?
We saw the entirety of the West Africa team based in Ghana were all fired. We don't know the numbers on the Brazil team, but researchers that I've spoken to in Brazil who normally interface with the Brazil team say that anyone that they worked with on Brazil's policy team is gone. They don't know if there's anyone left in the Brazil office. And in India, which was quite a large office, they fired about, I think, 180 out of 230, 240 people on that team. So the international staff has been severely cut. These teams are, at best, a skeleton crew already, if they continue to exist at all.
With all these employees piecing out, how will this impact its overseas users?
When we're thinking about the policy team side, oftentimes these regional or local offices were the ones that interface with local governments. I mean, for instance, in Brazil, there's an actual electoral court that will review content that may be disinformative about elections or electoral processes or election results. And obviously, Brazil just had a big election, a big runoff. Part of a lot of these social media companies is making sure they have teams or at least a person that they can be in contact with these government entities if there's a takedown request, if there's something problematic. And with policy teams being laid off, you know, those people are not there anymore to do that kind of incredibly important work of interfacing with governments and figuring out how platforms need to abide by local laws.
It's interesting. People are already mourning the death of Twitter, perhaps very prematurely. Is it actually possible this is the beginning of the end, or do you think Twitter can right the ship?
I saw someone on Twitter compare the end of Twitter not to something where it's going to implode overnight, but to an abandoned mall where people will just slowly stop visiting it.
What's at stake for the world if Twitter becomes an abandoned mall?
You know, I think in the U.S., it's very easy for us to be like, oh, this is a hell site. I don't like it. But the reality is, in many places in the world, Twitter is an incredible space for free speech. I mean, I think about how in 2020, the Hong Kong protesters were giving advice to the Black Lives Matter protesters on Twitter about here's what to do if, you know, you get tear gas thrown at you, the ability to protest, to, you know, hold governments to account in the small way that's possible. I mean, there's a reason that these platforms, Twitter and others, are often targeted by governments when they worry that there's going to be protests, when they worry that there's going to be dissent. And it's because they're incredibly powerful. And Twitter, more than most, has been willing to take hits to ensure that it protects users. I mean, last year, Nigeria banned the platform for the majority of the year because they took down a tweet from the president that violated the platform's terms of service. And, you know, that speaks to the power that these platforms have, and governments know it.
Victoria Elliott is a platforms and power reporter at Wired. She's been covering the meltdown at Twitter. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
If you feed cannabis to a cow, what happens? Do they stare into space, eat more hay, or ask the farmer to put on some Lil Wayne? Well, we have the answer. A group of German scientists fed some dairy cows THC from industrial hemp, a crop that's booming among farmers around the world and a promising potential feedstock. As the world's Anna Kussmer reports, the cows were definitely feeling it.
One group of cows was fed the usual, corn and hay. One group was fed hemp.
They really got calm, started slobbering.
Robert Pieper led the study published this week in the journal Nature Food.
They had red eyes and they got drowsy.
Pieper leads the food safety department at the German Federal Institute for Risk Assessment.
We see an increasing popularity for industrial hemp worldwide being grown.
Pieper says there are questions about whether hemp is ethical to feed to cows and safe in food systems. First things first, they observed slobbering and red eyes, I had to ask. Were the cows high?
Scientifically, we are not at that point to understand feeling or emotions of dairy cows in a way that we could call them high.
Fair enough. Another important question was, did the psychoactive compound found in hemp, THC, make its way into the cow's milk? The answer was yes.
The consumption of milk with these THC levels could result in intake levels that exceed the so-called acute reference dose for humans.
Too much THC to pass European safety standards. And it also resulted in less milk production. But this doesn't close the door on hemp as a feedstock, says Michael Kleinhens, who studies this at Kansas State. He finds cows who eat hemp are more chill, literally producing less cortisol.
And they also increased their lying time compared to their placebo cohort in the same group, in the same pasture.
Kleinhens says cows being more relaxed could have other benefits for farmers. It could make transporting the cows easier. And there's so much more to study when it comes to feeding hemp to cows. There are a lot of factors that can be tweaked, like the types of hemp and the mixture of psychoactive compounds found in each variety. Hemp is a versatile plant that can grow in places corn can't. It was illegal to grow in the U.S. for decades until recently.
And industrial hemp is just behind the eight ball, essentially. Now that we can finally grow it, now we have to figure out where we can utilize it.
This German study only had 10 cows. But Kleinhens says these findings are important.
No one's really looked at milk until this paper came out. So that helps provide some context with how much they cross from the blood into the milk of cows.
As it turns out, the study also caught the eye of other milk specialists. Natalie Davis is a neonatologist at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. She studies how THC finds its way into the breast milk of lactating humans.
Veterinary medicine and human medicine don't interact too much. So something like this is really great to, because it's similar, right? It's looking at gestating females and their milk production.
Davis says it's not just cows. There's a boom in cannabis substances available to consume these days, and scientists are desperately trying to keep up to keep everyone safe.
It has not been extensively studied because I think the medical community is really starting to appreciate, hey, this is something pervasive in our society. We need to look at it.
Davis agrees with the ultimate conclusion of European regulators. Until we know more, it's better not to drink the milk of a mammal who has ingested THC. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
You're listening to The World. When the pandemic hit, away went the cars. In London, road space was handed over to cyclists and pedestrians. Now many drivers want their space back, but some parents aren't having it.
I think the default position is often that the car is the road user, not the cyclist, not the person trying to cross the road, you know, with a buggy and a kid.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The World Cup of Soccer starts on Sunday in Qatar. There's a reason we're resurrecting Budweiser's Wazza Bad campaign from 2 decades ago. A few guys sitting around.
Just watching the game, having a bud.
No Buds or Budweisers at games in Qatar, though. Today, the Conservative Kingdom announced it is banning the sale of alcohol at World Cup stadium sites. It's a stunning reversal from a decision made a decade ago to allow beer sales. To discuss this further and concerns about the overall fan experience in Qatar, we're joined by Tariq Panja. He's a global sports reporter with the New York Times and joins us from Qatar. Tariq, did anyone see this decision coming? I mean, was this even on the radar?
just a week ago, we got this story that a very senior royal from the Qatari ruling family did a walkthrough and was uncomfortable when he saw these red Budweiser tents that had been erected in the past 3 weeks. They were too visible, he said. So they wanted to move them to a more, they described, discreet location away from where most of the footfall would be. And that gives you a sign of the continuing tensions. And then in the last 24, 48 hours, this kind of rumor started to percolate that no beer at all inside the perimeter. And I couldn't quite believe that, given that just 4 or 5 days ago, the same Qatari organizers had issued a statement to say, yeah, we're moving it aside, but there will still be beer. And that is a stunning, stunning move from them.
So what's been the reaction from FIFA, soccer's global governing body, about this very last-minute decision?
Very little. They put a statement out. They said, you know, this is conversation about the overall fan experience. This is what the outcome was. But they couldn't really say anything because they look horrible. It looks like their event has been taken away from them. They look completely powerless. And anything they were going to say, anything more forceful than that, would have upset the Qataris. The Qataris are in complete control of this event. That is very clear now.
What about Budweiser? I mean, the big sponsor of the World Cup and the beer supplier. What have they said?
We're still waiting for an official statement. But there was a tweet from Budweiser account that was deleted that kind of expressed their surprise.
Yeah, I think they said, well, this is awkward.
And indeed it is, because certainly Budweiser's relationship with FIFA is a really important one for both parties. This is a brand and a competition that have been intertwined for almost four decades. That is significant. And for them to be rolled like that by the Qataris and FIFA in this sense isn't a good look.
Now, Qatar is not a completely dry country. What can thirsty fans do to access alcohol during their stay there?
There are going to be specific fan zones where supporters from all over the world can join together and have a drink if they want to. And music festivals away from the main center of Doha, they'll be able to drink there as well. It's an awkward situation here. You know, for many people, it isn't the fact that Qatar has banned beer, because that is the headline news. And just 2 days before, they've pulled the rug from under them. People have booked their tickets, hoping to have the World Cup experience. And in many cases, that includes having a good time with beer. This is the frustration, that this could all have been cleared up years ago. They could have just said, nope, this isn't in our culture. This is the World Cup we want to have here. Come if you like. But that's not what they did.
Are there concerns that Qatar might renege on other promises and expectations during the World Cup?
As we've seen, things can be turned upside down on a diktat from a member of the ruling elite. Of course, there is this sense, and perhaps things that are more serious than having a pint. For example, homosexuality is criminalized in Qatar, and they've been pressed on this over the years. And the line is, everybody's welcome. Now, everybody's welcome today, but will they be welcome next week? What if suddenly the same people that decided there's no alcohol allowed will say, actually, nope, we don't want gay people in this country. And if you do engage in anything, we will potentially arrest you or throw you out of our country.
What's the mood in Qatar right now with the tournament set to start on Sunday?
To be honest with you, I've covered a few of these World Cups, and it feels a little bit artificial for now. This is pretty much a country that has been entirely rebuilt for this football tournament. What we're missing is the public. By that, we mean the thousands of fans from the competing nations and beyond to give you this air of World Cup feeling.
Now, Tariq, you're a sports guy. Any quick predictions you'd like to share with us for the actual matches?
Let me caveat this with the fact that I'm always wrong. So do not put any money on what I'm about to say. Brazil, I feel they're coming to this tournament with the deepest roster among all the 32 teams and the deepest they've had for a long time. I think they might be the team to beat here. So keep an eye on them.
Tariq Panja is a global sports reporter with the New York Times. He's been speaking to us from Qatar. Tariq, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now to part two of a story we started yesterday about Uganda getting into the oil business. The country discovered commercial quantities of the stuff back in 2006. Now Uganda's government is taking steps to build the East African crude oil pipeline. It will run from the western part of the country all the way across Tanzania to the Indian Ocean. Both countries are saying the project will help boost development and energy security, but this planned pipeline is facing a lot of heat in East Africa and abroad. The world's Halima Gikandi visited Western Uganda to understand why.
The village of Kijumba is surrounded by green on all sides, with lots of banana trees and cassava plants. 49-year-old Hope Ali Naitwe has spent her whole life here. Ali Naitwe tells me how she lives off her land, planting avocados, mangoes, and other fruits and vegetables. But recently, she has had to give that all up. Ali Naitwe says a few years ago, she was told that some of her land would be needed for the new oil pipeline and that she would be compensated. As Ali Naitwe waited for her money, she says she was told to stop cultivating her land. So she did, and lost out on 4 years of earnings. This September, she did get compensated. But the money wasn't very much, and it's already gone, she tells me. Now she can't afford to send her kids to school and struggles to make a living. Ali Naitwe's experience highlights what has become a flashpoint in these early days of development for this oil project, and that's land. Many rural Ugandans are cash poor, but land rich. Nearby, I meet Rachel Tugume, who's been through a similar experience.
They told me that, oh, Rachel, your land, the pipeline is going to pass through your land. So I waited for them to come, and in 2019, they came and they stopped me from using my land. I was growing cassava. I was a farmer.
She tells me how she was offered about $130 US for her land. That's way under value, Tugume tells me. So she refused and decided to hold out for a better deal.
Here, land is very expensive. Once they realize that there is oil and gas that has come up in Uganda, and they're just nearby, it's just behind those mountains you see. The land is very, very expensive.
Land is the only asset Tugume has, and now much of hers is overrun by weeds.
If you have cassava in our place, you're a good farmer and you're a rich person. Mm. Yes.
This is fertile land, just not being used.
Yeah. Now it's like 2 years. I'm not using it.
Tugume tells me she's still in negotiations with pipeline authorities. She says her issue isn't with the oil pipeline itself, but with the impact it's having on locals like her.
We are near the oil and gas, we are near the airport, and we are the people who are affected. At least they could come and help us and also take us to school, because some of us have not gone for higher education, so that we can also benefit from the oil and gas.
In the district of Bulisa, on the shores of Lake Albert, there's a central oil processing facility being built. This is where I meet John. He asked to only use his first name. He tells me he was sued when he refused to sell his land for the pipeline project. But he lost in court, lost his land, and where he's living now is right next to a construction site.
My children are not in school. I cannot have enough money to earn my living. Even too, with the pipelines, you can see now, there is a lot of noise, a lot of sand, dust, a lot of floods of water.
For activists, this issue of land compensation proves that this pipeline isn't going to help ordinary people in Uganda. Dickens Kamugisha is with AFIEGO, the Africa Institute for Energy Governance.
There is no way you can expect these huge projects to benefit the poor people, the average people. Still, the money will be earned, and only the rich, the powerful, will be the ones to take that money.
This month, AFIEGO sued Uganda and Tanzania over the oil pipeline project at the East African Court of Justice. The group argued that the project violates international laws and regional environmental treaties. There's been a lot of concern about the potential environmental impact of the pipeline. I visit the Bugoma Forest, also in western Uganda. It's a protected area bursting with biodiversity. Nazario Asimwe works in conservation here. He guides me through the forest, pointing out some of the wildlife.
We have elephant, we have a chimpanzee, we have a manga bee, Uganda manga bee, and also we have a carabas monkey, we have orva baboon, and also a nocturnal animals also.
Environmental activists are concerned about how the pipeline project could potentially impact this forest, and especially the chimpanzees that live here.
Because the chimpanzees, they move everywhere. They can move where they want to construct the pipeline.
He worries the construction could disrupt the chimpanzees' habitat. Both the Ugandan government and the oil companies involved have responded to critics by saying that they are taking measures to mitigate any potential negative impact of this development project. But Dickens Kamugisha of Afyego says that's not enough. Fossil fuels, he says, are not the answer for Uganda.
I don't think we should be saying let's also destroy this nature for us to be able to make money. Money for what? We can harness our nature and ensure that we get money, but we also sustain our environment. And any argument that we should also follow the path that the West did, it is very absurd and it is very unfortunate.
He says Uganda should learn from the experiences of other African countries like Nigeria, which has paid a heavy environmental price for its oil development and still remains poor. For the world, I'm Halima Gikondi, Hoima, Uganda.
Check out part one of Halima's report on our website, theworld.org. During the pandemic, many London neighborhoods drastically changed their road networks. They reduced car access and expanded cycling and walking options. It just made sense during those long months under lockdown. Well, that time has passed. Now some Londoners, including elected officials, want to give those roads back to car traffic. But as Russell Newlove reports, that's not going to happen without a fight.
Under the cover of darkness, construction workers appeared outside Chisenhale Primary School. They'd been sent to rip out what we call here in London a school street. That's an area where cars are banned during pick-up and drop-off time. But the kids were having none of it. Students as young as three came out to occupy the street, forcing the workers to turn around and go home. This is from a video shot by one of the parents, Sarah Gibbons. She tells me that the protest actually worked.
Pouring with rain that night, and very, very windy, so it was not a nice night to be out there. But we had kids, the older kids in particular, who came out with their wellies on, in their pyjamas, with their umbrellas, and stood in front of the contractors and stopped them taking away the space, essentially.
The construction workers were there on orders from the mayor of this area, called Tower Hamlets. He wanted the roads open to car traffic 24 hours a day. Reopening the roads, as he had called it, had been a key pledge in last year's local elections. Sarah Gibbons says the policy is out of line with priorities.
I really struggle with that because I think, well, you're talking about opening up the roads for 2 hours a day, essentially, and those 2 hours are golden hours in terms of protecting kids. It felt that our kids' lives were being put at risk because of a kind of an ideology.
The ideology being that roads are, first and foremost, for cars. But this particular school was opened in 1893, a full year before Britain's first automobile even hit the road. Even today, just 30% of households in the borough of Tower Hamlets have access to a car.
It's 9 o'clock in the morning and time for school. I'm at the gates of a primary school, that's an elementary school, in South London. The gate is as wide as a door, and as more and more children and parents arrive, bottlenecks appear. The sidewalk gets crowded. It spills over, and all that's protecting these kids from a road, a very busy road, is thin air.
Lots of kids on narrow pavements, lots of cars zooming by, traffic jams, bus just went past, an ambulance, so it's busy, really busy.
Jane Dutton walks her kids to school along this road every weekday. She's also an activist for Mums for Lungs, a grassroots organisation seeking to reduce the exposure of young children to pollution, particularly on their way to and from school.
We campaign for cleaner air for everybody. Primarily our focus is on children because they are some of the most vulnerable in society.
Most London schools are in densely populated urban neighbourhoods, where kids on foot or bikes are forced to share the roadways with lots of cars.
It's a 20-mile-an-hour zone, but the cars often speed through that. It's a bus route. There's a couple of zebra crossings. Often I have to stop my children because cars just go straight through them, and it's pretty scary, actually. Last year, about 170 children died or were seriously injured whilst walking and cycling on London's roads. So there's a real issue there with safety.
Mums for Lungs wants local councils to install more school streets, not to take them away. That would make it safer for everyone to walk, cycle, scoot, run, skip, anything to reduce the number of cars on the roads. London's first school street was installed in 2017. During the pandemic, as walking and cycling grew in popularity, the number of school streets shot up, and now there are more than 500 designated streets in London. But some London drivers want unfettered car access to be restored. And populist politicians can capitalise on that, because drivers are adults, and adults are voters. That's something Chisenhale parent Sarah Gibbons tells me that she's well aware of.
It seems as though kids are overlooked road users.
Yeah, I think they absolutely are. I don't think they're even seen as road users, actually. I think the default position is often that the car is the road user, not the cyclist, not the person trying to cross a road, you know, with a buggy and a kid, holding onto a kid with another hand. And kids in particular are not seen in that space at all.
The kids of Chisenhale School have definitely now been seen. Their protest made national news, and they got tweets of support from around the world. I asked Tower Hamlets Council for a comment, but they never responded. Parents tell me there is still uncertainty about the future of their school street, but they say the kids are prepared to go into the streets again if need be. For The World, I'm Russell Newlove in London.
The biggest event in soccer, the World Cup, kicks off this Sunday in Qatar. It's a tiny country bordering Saudi Arabia, jutting out into the Persian Gulf. Its enormous deposits of natural gas have made it wealthy and influential. And its connection to this year's World Cup goes back more than a decade.
The winner to organize the 2022 FIFA World Cup is Qatar.
That's Sepp Blatter in 2010. He was head of the World Cup's governing organization, FIFA. While the Qatari delegation cheered the announcement, many of those in the audience appeared unmoved. Qatar promised they had made the right decision.
Thank you for giving Qatar a chance, and we will not let you down.
5 years later, the soccer world imploded. CNBC had this report.
It's the largest corruption scandal in the history of football's world governing body, FIFA. In the early hours of Wednesday morning in Zurich, Swiss police stormed a luxury five-star hotel and arrested seven senior FIFA officials.
Allegations of kickbacks and bribery were not new to FIFA. Journalists like Roger Bennett saw Qatar's winning bid as just one more example of corruption in the sport.
And it felt that this nation that's smaller than Connecticut, a desert nation which had really no true footballing history, 113th in the world when it was awarded the bid, knowing FIFA, it could only be as a result of corruption.
Bennett is the author of the book Gods of Soccer.
And so that moment in 2015 really just validated everything that we knew in our guts to be true.
Qatar just didn't make sense for a soccer tournament.
The country of Qatar is surrounded by the warm waters of the Persian Gulf. So it's humid, it's hot, it's the perfect recipe for really heat exhaustion.
So Qatar poured its petrodollars into overcoming the problem. This promotional video from 2017 portrays the first of Qatar's eight stadiums to be completed, a marvel of engineering. It has a retractable roof. Architects designed the stadiums to minimize exposure to direct sun. They used reflective surfaces and massive banks of cooling fans. And FIFA rescheduled the 2022 World Cup to November to avoid the hottest summertime temperatures. But the building of the stadiums, hotels, metro lines, all the World Cup infrastructure took place in every season, hot, hotter, and hottest. For over a decade, some 2 million laborers have worked construction sites in Qatar's torrid temperatures, which in July can top 110 degrees. Migrant workers from countries such as Bangladesh, India, Nepal, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka came expecting good pay and decent working conditions. But soon came reports of workers injured in falls, construction accidents. Many died from acute heart or respiratory failure. Reporter Pete Pattison has chronicled the lives and deaths of construction workers in Qatar. In this video report for The Guardian newspaper, Pattison filmed families grieving in Nepal. They watched in horror as the bodies of young Nepalese laborers flown home from Qatar in signature red coffins were unloaded in their village, ready for cremation. Pattison saw this over and over again.
Despite assurances from the World Cup organizers that workers' rights will be respected, these deaths are just the worst examples of the exploitation and abuse which is rife in Qatar's construction industry.
More than 6,500 migrant workers have died in Qatar since 2010. That's according to The Guardian. Qatari organizers say just three people died from workplace accidents. Under international pressure, Qatar eventually did introduce reforms, but many said it was too late and far too little. Roger Bennett says that watching the game for him will be a complicated experience.
We must always hold, in this case, the darkness that has occurred off the field. But once that ball is kicked, it almost anaesthetizes us as fans. We forget the darkness. We forget the bureaucratic horrors. And we almost have just drifted off into the transcendent poetry of the game.
The first match of World Cup 2022 between Qatar and Ecuador takes place on Sunday. I'm going to let you in on a little secret. We at The World can predict Latin Grammy winners. It's true. Yesterday, reporter Tibisa Asea profiled Uruguayan singer-songwriter Jorge Drexler. Then just a few hours later, bam, seven Latin Grammys, including Best Song of the Year for Tocarte. 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 But wait, there's more. In September, we spoke to music producer Carlos José Álvarez about his grandma Angela and her debut album, which she recorded at the age of 94. Last night, Angela Álvarez won the Latin Grammy for Best New Artist. See what I'm talking about? Now, lots of artists get flustered or teary when they accept a big award, but not Álvarez. She stood on that stage with her eyes clear and her voice strong. She said, I want to dedicate this award to God and to my beloved Cuba. She added, to those who have yet to make their dreams come true, know that although life is hard, there's always a way. I promise you, it's never too late. Her grandson, Carlos, told us a little bit about what she had to go through.
You know, she lived through the revolution. She sent her kids off to the United States unaccompanied. Her husband, my grandfather, who died before I was born, I never met him. He had passed away of cancer. And then her daughter later died. My aunt died of cancer as well. And she just kept writing.
Writing and singing, but just for the family, until Carlos helped her record a studio album. Hoy quiero cantar a mi Cuba bella. Hoy tal vez voy a llorar. Last night at the Latin Grammys, Angela Álvarez was in her element. She even burst into song for the news cameras. Ay, yo no puedo olvidarte, pedacito de cielo. A ti quiero volver. Carlos said she's loving every minute.
She never in a million years thought this was going to happen, that she was going to be able to record her album and have her music live on like this. So, you know, to really have her experience, you know, people coming up to her and saying, I heard your music. It is just, you know, given her this incredible amount of energy and happiness and feeling that she's complete.
And all this Grammy stuff, he says, it's just icing on the cake. Mis años de infancia y todas mis ansias. That's where we'll leave you this week. If you want to win a Grammy, get in touch. We might even branch out to the Oscars. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you back here on Monday. Ese bello rincón que añoro cada día.
Marco here with a word before we go. A reminder that our fall fundraiser is happening right now. If you donate $100, you'll get a special shout-out on the podcast in early 2023. And everyone who donates will be invited to a virtual party with our newsroom on January 19th. So what are you waiting for? Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give. Thank you, and be well.